I'm here with Greg Shupak. He's a PhD student living in Guelph, and he's also a writer and community activist. So, Greg, tell us what you witnessed this past, from Friday, June 25th to 27th, 2010, at the protests against the G20 agendas.
I was in, as you said, I was in Toronto on Friday, June 25th and Saturday, June 26th. And the most basic observation I have is that we paid $1 billion for our own oppression. That money was not spent to keep people safe or even to protect property. It was spent to keep us quiet. In a sense, capitalist democracies depend on the willingness of most of us to pay for either to be exploited and be repressed or to have others treated in this way. But the weekend of the G20 was a particularly obvious, visible manifestation of this. Why this was allowed to happen and whether we want to continue to allow this to happen, these are the sorts of questions that an independent inquiry into the summit would need to ask. Beyond that, I'd want to ask your listeners, do you wish to continue to pay to be oppressed and exploited or to have others be oppressed and exploited? And if not, what productive actions can we take to change the system that allows this? I'll let your listeners decide for themselves, but based on my own observations, it seems fairly clear to me that the police were under politicized orders to allow the vandalism to take place, which is not to say that provocateurs were used. That wouldn't surprise me, but I haven't seen convincing evidence of that yet. So moving on to what I experienced, I should say that I was not arrested or physically harmed. The most invasive experience I had was minor. Under some pressure, I had my backpack searched outside of Allen Gardens on the Friday, where my friend and I were going to join in the Justice for Our Communities march. One of the officers thought I shouldn't be allowed to enter the park unless I turned over the safety glasses I had in my bag to guard against the tear gas that, for good reason, I thought might be deployed. However, his two co-workers convinced him to let me enter with the glasses.
It seems that it was a common thing for police to be just arresting people for simply having, like you said, goggles and handkerchiefs or...
Yeah, I actually didn't bring it Saturday just to avoid hassle. But I mention this as an incident because I realized that people were detained for carrying goggles later on Saturday and on Sunday. So in a different situation, the result could have been different. So Friday's march began with a high level of energy, but given the heat and for reasons I couldn't quite identify, the march was forced to go very slowly. I ultimately felt that demonstration was a bit lifeless. There were positives. We passed the hospitals in University Avenue, and hospital workers waved to us, gave us thumbs up. My friend has a broken leg, so she's temporarily in a wheelchair, and organizers and other demonstrators were extremely accommodating, which I felt was good. And overall, the crowd was large and made up of people from a wide range of ethnocultural and socioeconomic backgrounds, which is also encouraging. Mm-hmm. Significantly, police had formed an airtight wall around Friday's march. Corporations, banks, government buildings, all were guarded like as if they were holy sites in the Middle East. Impenetrable walls of police officers in front of them. As we passed Starbucks, I said to my friend, "I guess the days of trashing Starbucks at summits are over." In fact, if somebody called me right then and said, "Greg, we're holding your family hostage, and if you don't break the window of Starbucks, we're going to shoot them all," I wouldn't have been able to break the window, because the instant anyone would have turned with a projectile in hand, you would have been tackled by police. It was impossible to do anything like that. The rows of police? In some cases, yes. In other cases, it may have only been one row, but it was officers side by side, shoulder to shoulder with full riot gear. Watching. It would have been extremely difficult to do any sort of vandalism that day. So this is part of why I think it's clear the police had orders to let Saturday's vandalism occur. It was extremely odd that everywhere I was in the city over those 2 days, there was airtight security. Police were literally everywhere, zipping this way and that at a moment's notice. And yet, for some reason, police cars were left alone and absolutely no one was around to stop them from being lit on fire on Saturday. Let's just do a thought experiment. If you're a politician or a politicized police commander and you wanted to stop property damage, would you leave major corporations and bank unguarded, particularly when you know that these are always the targets of vandalism at major international summits? I'm guessing not. You don't have to be a well-paid security expert or something to know that. And in fact, a very conservative morning radio host on 1010 Radio...
Is that in Guelph?
No, it's just a Toronto thing. So one of their hosts claims that officers had told him off the record that they were prevented from stopping the vandalism, as did Joe Warmington, a reporter with the Toronto Sun. And the Toronto Sun, as you, most of your listeners will know, is a paper that thrives on a sort of tough law and order agenda. In other words, they're not the type to typically be sympathetic to demonstrators. But this guy, Joe Warmington, said that many police officers, none of whom wanted to go on the record at this point, complained that they were held back and told not to stop the vandalism.
Whoa.
And this is all out there for anybody who wants to look it up online. Now, getting back to what I saw, on Saturday I marched with my father, a couple of friends, and 25,000 others from Queen's Park. The group was energetic, made up of people with a huge range of socioeconomic environmental concerns. Women took a leading role in the march by focusing on Harper's plan to deny funding to programs in the Global South that provide abortion services. Clearly, this initiative would have devastating effects on maternal health, would exacerbate poverty, and represents a very colonial attitude under which the Harper government thinks that women in the South don't deserve the same rights as women in Canada. So I think having this be a focal point of the march was a good choice. The giant hanger that the women at the front were carrying was, in my opinion, a chilling and very effective visual. The march moved south on University and then north on Queen. At Queen and Spadina, marshals from some of the unions that were involved in the demonstration urged demonstrators to proceed north on Spadina, which was the so-called legal route of the parade, and then to go back to Queen's Park. But many, including myself and the people that I was with, rejected the idea that the state can determine where it is or is not valid to express dissent. So we were prepared to risk expressing this by going south on Spadina. There had been calls in advance of that Saturday on websites to break off and confront the security fence at this point. However, hordes of police in full riot gear were lined up roughly 300 meters south of Queen. So clearly nobody was going to make it to the fence at that point. Mm-hmm. When we were just south of Queen, the first act of vandalism took place. I didn't see it, but several police officers rushed through the crowd, which got my attention. Before long, we saw that a police car, which was very curiously sitting in the middle of the crowd, doesn't seem a particularly sensible place for a car to be, and certainly that was the only instance I saw of a cruiser in that position. We saw that that car had had one of its windows smashed, or one or more of its windows smashed. My assumption was that the police, when they circled around it, were guarding it to protect it from further damage and to get it out of there. I watched them guard it, form a circle around it, and then a line across Queen, and for an hour and a half they stood there guarding this police car. I presume this was the first vandalism that was done during the protest. At the time that they were guarding this was, and it wasn't too many of them, it was probably 30 to 40 police officers out of the thousands that were in the city. We didn't realize this, that while they were guarding it, that was when the more serious vandalism was taking place on Queen, which was sort of after or at the tail end of the march, and then down Yonge, nowhere near the march. I spoke to one person who had been at the very back of the march who saw some of the early vandalism, and he told me that the Black Bloc were booed by other demonstrators, interestingly. So, I mean, I think the real criminals are the ones who met inside the G20, and I don't think the Black Bloc vandalism makes a whole lot of sense, but I do think it's hypocritical and absurd to worry more about property damage than about war, poverty, and environmental degradation. Having been outside for several hours and having a keen desire to see Ghana beat the U.S. in the World Cup, we went into a bar and watched the end of the game. This is a bar on Queen Street, near where that car was damaged that I saw guarded for a long time. My father went home, and after the game, we went back onto the street. Now, hours after the demonstration had ended, and hours after the Black Bloc vandalism, the cruiser that the police had guarded was sitting alone. So I'd watched them guard this for an hour and a half, as if it was their most sacred piece of property, and now it was sitting by itself. I can't imagine why. It was, at this point, had more windows broken, spray paint, and so on. And then I watched that car be lit on fire and burn. This was not done by a Black Bloc person, but by someone the papers described as suffering from a mental illness. So it took an extremely long time for police to get back there, and even longer for firefighters. even though at that time no vandalism was occurring elsewhere and there were no other fires in the area. Later, my friend and I learned of a demonstration in Queen's Park. If you're like me, you think the idea that free speech and protest can only occur in a designated area is absurd, but nonetheless, Queen's Park was the area in which we were supposed to be able to exercise basic democratic rights without fear of repression. We tried to enter the park from the south and again from the west, but both were sealed by police. At first, I assumed it was impossible to get in, that they weren't letting people go in. And I even wondered if something really serious had happened there, because it looked like it was a serious emergency going on. Yeah, so at the west entrance, two young women were sitting silently in front of the police line. I had a cordial conversation with a very polite police officer. He told me that there was no trouble in the park and that we could enter from the north. So it took us 2 minutes to get to the north of the park. But yet, by the time we got there, immediately the police were forcing us all out aggressively. So 2 minutes ago, one guy told me there was no problem. And then all of a sudden, everybody's being forced out of their so-called free speech zone rather aggressively, as they say. They were rushing at us, brandishing batons, yelling at us, banging clubs on their shields, that sort of thing. Again, this was a very subdued demonstration from what I gather, based on what I saw before, in the moment before the rushing and during the police rushing itself, as well as on the videos. And again, I have to stress, this was in the so-called free speech zone. So, someone told us a nearby demonstrator who was not being violent in any way had been shot with a rubber bullet.
Calling it rubber makes it seem like it's less harmful.
That's true, but the word bullet to me implies it's clearly
harmful. Or just call it bullet.
Sure.
It's just, sometimes they even put glass in the plastic bullets to make even more of a damaging thing.
It certainly seems plausible to me. The Israeli military uses actual bullets and just paints them to look like plastic or rubber bullets and kills people with them. But
it's just like what people associate with the term rubber is.
Okay. Well, yeah,
like
I can see.
Off you
sure, I can see how someone might think that. To
it's
me, it's
bullet.
Clearly a problem. It's a
yes.
bullet coming out of a gun. Whatever.
Right.
It could be made of a pillow. It would still hurt. But yeah, this person had been hit with a plastic bullet, and later media reports seemed to verify this. I am also fairly confident that I heard shots. Around us, people who were not being physically confrontational with the cops were manhandled and or knocked over by police and then arrested. We all held our line as long as we could, and not terribly far from where I was, many sat down in front of the police and were trampled, beaten, and arrested. These were very moving, courageous, principled acts by many of the demonstrators, and I want to commend them in the strongest possible terms. Of course, the police ultimately dispersed the crowd, but I think we should be very proud of our conduct at Queen's Park. I was not arrested, but that was basically just dumb luck, because I easily could have been. People doing the same thing I was doing were arrested. Many. Later on Saturday, as your listeners will know, civil protests were broken up at the Novotel Hotel. People were arrested, beaten, and Sunday was basically one massive game of pin the cuffs on the protesters. This all reminds me of probably my favorite quote by Karl Marx, which is in a May 1871 essay on the Civil War in France, Marx writes, quote, "The civilization and justice of bourgeois order comes out in its lurid light whenever the slaves and drudges of that order rise against their masters. Then this civilization and justice stand forth as undisguised savagery and lawless revenge." I think it was an embryonic form of this that I saw in Toronto during the G20. I think it's important to view the G20 crackdown not as an isolated incident, but as one example, frankly, even a fairly mild one, though it may be hard to see it that way, of the violence and oppression that is routinely carried out by the self-proclaimed G20 leaders. We know Canadian officials committed war crimes, handing over prisoners to be tortured in Afghanistan. We know that, as reported by Amnesty International earlier this year, oil extraction on the land of the Lubicon Cree has led to, quote, high levels of poor health and increased poverty. Thanks to the British medical journal The Lancet, we know that over 1 million have been killed in the Iraq War. And we know, thanks to Professor David Harvey, that from 1980 to 2007, $4.6 trillion was transferred from the global south to the global north. So you can think about that when politicians are self-righteous about their so-called aid. So let us not lose sight of what actually was agreed to during the summit either. The G20 heads of government pledged to cut deficits in half by 2013. I can think of only two decent ways to achieve this deficit cutting. One would be by slashing on military spending, but there's no appetite for this in the midst of the so-called war on terror. In fact, the government, the current government in Canada has committed to dramatically increase military spending by 2020. The other way would be to demand restitution from the financial institutions that caused the current economic crisis. But the G20 elite obviously has no appetite for that, given that while in Toronto they decided not to adopt even a tiny tax on the riskiest financial transactions. The main observation I will take away from the summit is that we spent an unprecedented amount, exponentially more than at summits in other countries, to be repressed, to put many of our friends, allies, and community members in jail, and to intimidate many others, so that the heads of 20 of the world's most powerful countries, which set policies of organizations like the IMF and World Bank, could gut our social programs in half and continue doing what is done in the name of so-called lending and development in the Global South. The Canadian government, particularly under Harper, wants average people to be afraid to take political action. They want the general public to fear being beaten and arrested, and the repression of the G20 is part of that project. I think we must not give in to this bullying, and many more of us must become much more politically committed in response. I join Amnesty International, the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, and others in calling for an independent inquiry into police conduct during the G20, but I think we need to go further to overcome the day-to-day oppression that the G20 elites enact in Canada and around the world. To me, our choice is to either continue to pay for the excesses of the rich and the powerful, and to underwrite the exploitation and repression of ourselves and others, or we can engage in the serious work of building another world.
I really appreciate that you focused on the repression of the G20 agendas and the police, because that's what's totally not being focused on right now, and that's what should be prioritized, really, to try to improve things.